The attempt to pass that doorway resulted in the same dreadful pressure. I raged against it, bringing all my strength to bear, but it was like trying to force myself through stone. I withdrew, and the pressure relented. I could see Heraclian looking at me quizzically.
"You do not obey," he said.
I turned shakily to face the tribune, having to concentrate just to keep my footing. I felt drained and humiliated, and could not hope for my brothers to understand it. I was not accustomed to failure, but there was no way I could cross that threshold.
"I cannot," I said, which was just about all I could get out.
Then I turned my back on the throne, for as long as I had lived, the object of all my devotion, and stumbled back out into the dark.
Chapter 6. Alea. I came too late. In all that happened afterwards, the blood and the folly, I think, that remains the hardest burden to bear. I had a sense of it from a long way out. I'd taken the interceptor back up into the hull of my transport, the Kadamara, and ordered the captain to make full haste back to Aresa. It had been a bad journey, as they all were now, with several drops back into real space to avoid the navigators losing their limited grip on reality. I seethed the whole time. There was nothing more frustrating than knowing something bad had been unleashed and being prevented from intervening. It was just a word, hissed from the mouth of a deceiver, but my soul knew it to be true. I say my soul, but of course I'm speaking figuratively. We still had hunches. By the time we finally arrived into a race's system limit, all my fears were swiftly confirmed. The beacons were gone, smashed into a belt of spinning metal. Just out from the Mandeville point, we encountered the corpses of two Navy monitors. It looked like they'd got a few shots away before the end came, but not much more than that. "Take us straight in," I ordered in battle sign, standing on the bridge next to the captain. "Full burn." The crew did not hesitate to comply. We were relatively lightly armed by naval standards and thus running a terrible risk, but if there was any chance of arriving in time, then we had to take it. Arriving at a planet after a void raid is always a strange experience. Unless something truly apocalyptic has occurred, there's never any sign of trouble from the augurs. A world, even the smallest, is just too vast to show signs of pinpoint attack. Aresa was no different. It looked just as I always remembered it from 100 homecomings, pearl-white and banded with drifting cloud banks. The orbital defences, though, were gone. Tumbling fragments circled like a planetary ring, blasted dark. There were more empty ship hulls drifting, all powered down. Most were the kind of things I'd have expected to see. Trading barges, landers and lifters, a few void-capable Zeta-grade haulers. There should have been Navy ships there too, a dozen of them. But there was no sign, not even wrecks. "Do you want us to hold anchor, Lord?" Captain Erefan asked quietly. No, I did not. I gave him a quick flurry of battle sign orders, then went down to the hangars to find the interceptor. Just as before, I went alone. There was no use in risking their lives on the ground, and in any case I wanted the Kadamara to scan the system for any hostiles still remaining. It looked like we'd come far too late to play any meaningful part, but you never knew what foulness might linger. I was feeling sick by then, mostly from frustration and fear, not for myself, but for those who manned the convent walls. There was nothing else of military value on the planet, nothing else that might have drawn the attention of the enemy. That was why Hestia had chosen it, carefully keeping us away from the roving eyes of both Imperial and other authorities. I took my place in the cull, watched the hangar bay doors creak open, and powered the ship out into the void. I pushed it hard down through the atmosphere, making the forward viewers roar with fire. As the superstructure shook, I pushed the ship harder, taking a little sour pleasure in hurting it. That had always been my weakness, a desire for violence that ran beyond the righteous. At that point, though, I could hardly admonish myself for it. I was worried and keyed for battle, and increasingly sure I had missed out on the action. As I plunged beneath the clouds and levelled out over Novian Urban Primus, the damage became clear at last. 6 of the great hives were on fire, sending smoke boiling out of rents in their sides. The urban lowland between them was also burning, punched through as if by massive bullet holes. Flyers were everywhere, swarming like angry and impotent wasps. My console flashed with alerts as ongoing activity, fighting, was picked up, but I cared nothing for those signals. I drove the cull steeply, not bothering to hide my approach as I would normally have done. As I neared my destination, I could see the palls of inky smoke rising, thicker and more concentrated than anywhere else. Our convent was housed in what passed for a regular ecclesiarchy basilica. The occupants looked like priests or ministerium menials. The sisterhood could easily be mistaken for a minor order of the Adepta Sororitas. Anyone looking too closely might have noticed that we were nothing of the sort, and that we never had visitations from the true diocesan authorities. But Hestia had always made sure no one looked too closely. We paid the tithes and bribes we needed to, cultivated the right members of the planetary Arbites fortresses, and pursued our true vocation under a cloak of semi-obscurity. Now, though, the entire grid had been levelled. Whole hab towers had been demolished, their outer structures slumped into scorched piles of scree. As I wound down the engines to land, I could hear the rumble of ongoing destruction, laced with the screams of thousands. The air itself was black down here, thick with tattered ashes. I pulled into the ruined hangar, its blast doors melted away, cut the power, and leapt from the cull's cockpit. The interior was charred, and bodies of servitors and menials littered the apron. All the ships that had stood here before were gone, looted just as Eraser's standing naval detachment must have been. I ran inside, leaping over the corpses, my flamer primed and ready. The corridors were thick with more ruin, bodies thrown against the walls, doorways demolished, libraries ransacked, and still smouldering. I began to think that there would be nothing left. I raced towards the command nexus, buried deep under the false ministerium shell. The whole place stank of blood and burning. I pushed through broken doors, expecting just the same scenes of destruction, and found a creature of outer hell waiting for me. I have no idea why this one was still there. Its comrades were long gone, fled back into the warp, as was their habit. But one remained. Perhaps it had been intended as a sentinel to guard against my return, or perhaps they had fought among themselves in their base fashion, and left one of their number as some kind of punishment for weakness. I cared not. It was there, ahead of me, hunched over the corpse of one of my precious sisters, its claws running with her blood. It was massive. Its black armour was thick and ether-pitted, inscribed with curls and spikes of gold over a matte black base. It breathed like a beast breathes, condensation spilling from its ornate vox grill. In one hand it held its prey, in another a spattered chainsword. I was screaming as I charged it, inwardly, of course, but the screams were real enough. I leapt high before it was even aware of me, my flamer bursting into life. It turned at the last moment and we crashed together. My momentum was vicious, but it was heavy as a tank and just as deadly. I punched at its helm through my flames, taking savage satisfaction in its roar of surprise. Then the chainsword geared up, swinging throatily through the fire. I pulled away, emptying my flamer into its face as it lumbered closer, slashing wildly. Its movements were as fast as mine, though much heavier. I could smell the corruption spilling from it, the long-wearing corrosion of its warp-soaked home. It was badly wounded, a long gash down one flank, which perhaps explained its exile here.
"Anathema,"
it croaked, swinging at me. At least it knew what it was fighting. The longer this went on, the more likely it was I would die. My purpose was to blunt the Shedim, the apparitions of dreams, not the physical servants of enemy. Despite its wounds, it was stronger than I was, built for this kind of fight, and it had already ended scores of my sisters in their own citadel. But I was enraged. I was near blind with it, and it made me stronger. I shoved the flamer into its outstretched chainsword, and the whirring teeth caught fire and spiraled madly. Then I was ducking under the flailing attack, using my size and speed and reaching for my rondel dagger. I pushed up, two-handed, driving the tip into the creature's jawline. The tip pierced, and I drove it in deep. Blood as black as pitch slopped over its gorget, and it caught me in a bear hug, crushing me against it. I felt it squeeze, and my armor flexed. The stench made me gag, and I struggled to breathe. All the while I pressed the dagger home, twisting, churning through flesh and bone. I felt something burst, and a cascade of stinking pus streamed over both of us. It crushed me further, and I heard the first crack in my breastplate. We were face to face. I was looking into its filmy helm lenses. Just below the surface of that grotesque armor, I knew that a once human was looking back at me, matching my hatred with its own. The pressure grew worse. It was crushing me to death. I was losing consciousness. I screwed my eyes closed, gathered all my remaining strength, and pushed upwards. Its vox grill shattered, and I propelled my blade up into its cranium. For a moment longer it clutched at me, hissing bloody spittle, and then the terrible pressure finally fell away. It collapsed, crashing into a heap of armor plates, gauntlets falling limp. I dropped to my knees on top of it, hauling breaths into my crushed lungs, barely able to see for the spinning stars crowding my vision. I clawed my way across its breastplate, back towards the opening at its neck. I ripped the helm from its head and gazed on the monster. Its flesh was white like gristle. Its eyes were bloodshot and swollen, its black tongue lolling from pierced lips. Its last expression was one of derangement and agony, which gave me some measure of fierce recompense. I took my own helm off to look at it unfiltered. Then I hawked up a gobbet and spat into its unseeing eyes. "For my sisters," I told it silently. I would have liked to mourn for longer, to immolate the bodies with the proper rites. But I knew time was already short. The entire grid sector had been ruined in the attack, but soon reinforcements would arrive from elsewhere on the planet, looking for a reason for the attack and digging down to its epicenter. That would bring unwelcome eyes to what remained of the convent, potentially undoing all we had built in secrecy. I got up from the corpse of the monster. The command nexus, an arch chamber placed like a crypt at the base of an old nave, had been thoroughly smashed. Bodies littered the cracked floor. Many were out of armor, perhaps dragged from their meditations or studies. One by one I saw the faces I knew, all battered and lifeless. I limped through the nexus and into the network of chambers beyond. The raiders had torched the archives, and the data coils were still acrid and smoking. The armory was empty, its contents either destroyed or looted. We did not have our own chapels, only the sham ones in the levels above, but our private cells where we trained and rested were ransacked. All were dead. The raiders had not come to seize anything, simply to destroy. Somehow, despite all our efforts, They had found out where we were based and assembled a force strong enough to nullify our defences and gut our citadel. That thought alone troubled me greatly. Our order was clandestine, but we were not undefended. The lower halls were shielded and augur resistant. We had heavy weapons and the crew to handle them. Any one of my sisters had been trained to fight the greatest dangers of the Imperium, and on their own ground were more than a match for those that had come after them. The fact that there were no bodies of the enemy did not mean that many had not died in the assault. Aside from the crippled one they had left behind, there was evidence of other casualties having been taken away, dragged heavily along the ground for retrieval of armor and gene seed. It was almost unheard of, even in those straitened times, for a sizable band of such warriors to assault a world like Erasa. There must have been so many monsters here, acting in such brutal, concentrated force. Perhaps that was the true reason they had left one behind. As a marker of things to come, to let the citizens of the Imperium know just what was now stalking them. My rage still burned as I kicked through the remnants, partly directed against myself. Perhaps it had been unwise to leave for Hellion, I thought, despite the fact that there had been no warning. Would my presence have changed anything? Probably not. I might have downed one, maybe two, but it was clear that the battle had been horribly one-sided. My ignorance of the coming attack was what had saved my life. It was both the great strength and the great weakness of our kind that we had no ready access to the warp. Our counterparts in the Adeptus Astartes employed the services of librarians and the finest astropaths, seers and mystics, and thus could often detect threats before they arose. We, on the other hand, were blind to that aspect of the universe. Our own navigators and astropaths were stunted things, barely able to operate in our presence, and thus we had no means of scrying the paths of the future by ourselves. It had been different, once. We had been part of the grand machinery of the Adeptus Terra itself, able to draw on its near infinite resources to bolster our unique martial expertise. That was how we had been designed, as interoperable parts of a greater whole. The Space Marine Legions were self-contained armies capable of doing everything, whereas we and the Custodian Guard had been complementary, just elements of a unified capability under the throne's combined gaze. But that was all so long ago. I had no idea if the Custodian Guard still existed as they once had. Everything had decayed so much, falling steadily away from its original purpose. We were like children, stumbling in the shadows, trying hard to remember old lessons before they were lost forever. And now the nightmares were coming back. The rooms marched past me, each one more decrepit than the rest. The raiders had been thorough. Every corridor brought a fresh brace of bodies, wedged and broken into the corners. Here and there I could see my sisters had attempted to form bulwarks against the tide, barricading themselves behind strong points and fighting hard. I hoped they had extracted a heavy toll before the end. There had to be a specific reason for this. It couldn't have been a random raid. The resources required were too enormous, the intelligence too precise. I remembered the crowing words of the woman on Hellion. "Doesn't matter now. It's all ending. And very soon." What was the circlet? Was it a creation of the old legions, then? Had our uncovering of its activities provoked this response, or had we been marked for destruction for some other reason? There was no sign of Hestia. Some of the other sisters were missing too, though I had no idea whether they had been absent on other missions. I reached the comm station with its annihilated transmitters. Crunching across a floor of broken crystal, I managed to find a local range emitter, which was still just about functional. I restored power to it from a half-empty cell and instructed it to broadcast a ciphered warning to stay away. I had no idea how long it would last, but at least it was something. From far above, I heard heavy crashes and the distant sound of human voices shouting. A search team, perhaps, finally making its way into the basilica. I would have to move on before they found me, but there were still some chambers to search. The last was that of Locke, the old astropath who had served Hestia faithfully for nearly 20 years. He had been a weakened man for much of that time, drained by his proximity to our foul, soulless ways, and yet he'd remained to do his duty. His body wasn't there, though there was a long slick of blood along the far wall. His cot had been smashed, and his books torched, leaving trails of soot across the crumbling plasterwork. I pushed my boot tip through the mess, sifting for anything retrievable. He'd been a writer of copious texts, had Locke, forever scribbling down his dreams before they drifted from his memory. Most of it had never made much sense, and had only limited value for guiding the convent, but Hestia had valued his loyalty, and on occasion his visions had proved both true and valuable. Very little of his stock of parchment had avoided the flames, and the few scraps that had survived were scrawled with endless lists of runes and astrological charts. I couldn't make any sense of them, and let them flutter back to the ground. It was only as I turned to leave that I saw the phrase written across the door itself in what looked like blood. The language was our own, the private script we employed for the most secret matters, and which to an untrained eye hardly looked like writing at all. Even I almost missed it. Once I saw the patches of dark red, I wondered how they could have been made. Had Locke written them before he'd died? Or even before the attack? In any event, it was unusually concise. He calls his daughters home. I looked at it for a long time. I didn't quite believe it. I wished Hestia were there to give me confidence in my judgment, but of course she couldn't be. I felt very alone then, stalking through the ruins of the only home I had ever known, now a haunt of corpses. I heard more noises from up above. I would have to make my way to the hangar before my route was cut off. There was nothing left to salvage here, though the scenes of destruction and the bodies encased in ancient armor would give the enforcers pause when they eventually arrived. I moved out carefully, keeping my dagger in hand. I'd have to get back to the Katamara swiftly, get out of range of Eraser, and then plan my next move. There were many possibilities, but I needed time to think, to start to make sense of what had happened. Grieving would come when I could afford it. Right now, I had to assume I was hunted, as were perhaps all my kind still operating out in the void. He calls his daughters home. I couldn't get the words out of my mind. They echoed as I broke into a run, fleeing through the blood-webbed corridors. What did it mean? What did any of it mean? I returned to the Katamara, hardly bothering to evade the clusters of frantic air traffic that threatened to bar my way. Civil defense assets had been fully mobilized by then, as had the matte-black flyers of the Planetary Arbites units. Their enforcers were effective troops, but I shudder to think what slaughter would have taken place had they arrived in time to disturb the true enemy. Even for us, I admit, there was a tendency to think of our foes as deranged and bloodthirsty, ever likely to sink into a berserk frenzy when the opportunity for slaughter presented itself. Some of them were, of course, and we had won battles on the basis of our greater discipline. But that was to underestimate the true masters of ruin, who fought as keenly and as shrewdly as they had once done as servants of terror. They were taking out identified targets, moving on before discovery, making the best use of their numbers. I thought again to the star map from Hellion. My thoughts were interrupted by the commencement of the docking cycle. I pulled inside the hangar, secured the interceptor, and made my way back to the command bridge. "Widespread damage to major planetary infrastructure," Erifan reported, somewhat superfluously. "No sign of enemy units remaining in system." There had been one, though, I thought to myself. My crew would need orders now. They would need to be told what to do and how to react. In the normal run of things, I would have given them what they needed without hesitation, but I was still in a state of shocked grief. Erifan must have sensed it, for he started giving commands without waiting for me. "Take us out of orbit," he commanded. "Beyond auger range, then hold for further instructions." The Kadamara swung round, bumping up against some tumbling wreckage, then boosted clear of the upper atmosphere. As we picked up speed for system exit, I saw the colossal outline of an Astra Militarum troop carrier emerge over the horizon. Eraser had its own regiments, and one had clearly been scrambled already. The cleanup was beginning. Then we were gone, boosting clear of the debris, and back out into the open void. Once the Kadamara's engines hit full tilt, the world shrank back quickly, first a pale orb, then a spot, then nothing. I knew somehow it would be the last time I would ever see it, and so watched the viewers the whole time to ensure I would remember the sight. The crew said nothing to me. Most averted their eyes, though I caught a few snatched upward glances from the scanner pits. They knew I had no soul. They were probably wondering whether I also lacked a heart. I sent a message to the ship's navigator, indicated for Erifan to carry on as he was doing, then went back to my own quarters. Once there, I retrieved the items I had taken from Helion, most of them still shrouded in null fields. I started to go through them all, activating any comm canisters I could find, studying the scraps of parchment and ritual prayers. After a while of this, the navigator Slovo appeared. I could sense the extreme wariness in him. It was harder for him than it was for human normals to be close to me. At least they were only partly psychic creatures, whereas Slovo was at the opposite end of the spectrum, a being wholly steeped in the tide of souls. I found him fairly objectionable too, but that was mostly down to poor personal hygiene. "You asked for me, Lord," he said, bowing stiffly. He was a skinny man, draped in dirty robes in his house colours. He had a long, hooked nose and sunken eyes. "We never managed to get the best to serve with us, only those who, for whatever reason, couldn't secure service with a more palatable branch of our glorious Imperium. But he was competent enough, and addicted to some of the less ruinous, sense-dulling narcotics." I gestured towards the great swath of human flesh, pinned up again between staves, and now adorning the far wall of my chamber. Slovo limped up to it and looked hard across the swirls of blood. "A warp map," he sniffed. "Basic error. You can't map the warp." My fingers flickered in a series of simple responses. He didn't understand, thought Mark, so we were limited to cruder phrases. "I don't care. Tell me what it means. Keep it concise." He looked more carefully.
"I see what they're doing," he said eventually. "These are representations, such as you can have them, of major channels. The kind of thing you'd bring a fleet down. They've been getting narrower, those channels. Remember I told you that? Perhaps they know why."
He traced a bony finger over the flayed cartograph, mumbling to himself. I let him carry on. I could never decide how much of this was for show or not. They like to guard their secrets, did those old mutants of the warp.
"Perhaps," he said, then trailed off again. "Perhaps, but maybe not."
I sent my fingers into a say it pattern. He shot me an irritated glance. I could see how much he hated me then. He understood the origin of that hatred,
and for that reason kept it suppressed as best he could, but it still spilled out from time to time. "Suppose they knew what was going to happen," he said. "Suppose they knew which way the tides were pulling. They might know that some channels would close and some would open. Then they'd have to keep control over the ones that were open. There would be worlds sitting at the mouths of those conduits. They could pour their filthy craft down those ways. It'd be difficult. They'd have to coordinate strikes over a huge span of space. And they'd have to be right about it all. I don't think this is a sensible scheme, though. I don't think it's possible." We had all got used to things thought impossible suddenly turning into reality, so I didn't place much confidence in that judgment. I looked at the map myself. It wasn't easy to study, for the shapes slid and baffled, like optical illusions. I saw systems picked out in a script I didn't recognize, some foul tongue of the eye, no doubt. Their arrangement was not as it was in real space, or I might have been able to identify them from our cartographic records, but instead showed their ether relationship, the way they stood set against the currents of the unseen realm. And this was forever in flux, so they told me. No static maps of it could be produced. The only use this had, then, was as the navigator said, if they somehow knew the future alignment of things. I drew closer to the center of the diagram. The nearer I drew to that point, the more the circles and pentagrams overlapped, drawing the eye down towards a single world. Even I could see the significance of that one, lodged like a jewel at the nexus of so many interwoven lines of blood. "Terra?" I indicated. Slovo shrugged.
"You can read this rubbish, can you? I can't. There are other cardinal worlds. Cadia, Hydrofur, Mars. I wouldn't want to make that judgment, not from what I see here."
I pushed down my irritation. The man did not mean to be insolent, but he was doing what every mortal always did when talking with me, fighting against repulsion. He wanted to get out of this room, and that instinct coloured everything he said. "All the same," I signed. He shrugged. I felt that I'd got everything out of him I was likely to. He'd be needed soon. He'd require at least some rest before I ordered us into the warp again. So I sent him away. Then I looked over the marks again, as if a final look could give me what I needed. I didn't derive any great inspiration from it. Those signs had been made for corrupted eyes, steeped in significance that mine would miss. Nonetheless, I could at least tally up the names of the worlds, for that would give me something. There were places of scholarship where I might be able to decipher that list, which would then go some way towards deciphering the map. But in truth, there were now very few places to go. We had been operating alone, sundered from the rest of our sisterhood, if indeed any still remained. I couldn't just set course for the next convent and hope to find refuge. I would have to make a choice. "He calls his daughters home." I went back up to the bridge, feeling the tremor of the decks under my boots as the ship burned out into the deep void. By the time I arrived back at station, Edifan was waiting for me.
"Your orders?"
he asked. "Run silent. Hold once out of system range." I signed. Then I looked up at the real viewers above me, already black and scattered with stars.
"But we're heading into the warp," Erifan said. "That's the intention."
I gave him no signal. I looked at the stars and tried to imagine how they would overlay onto that map. "It is," I signed, "to the throne world." That was a long way. The routes would all be perilous, clogged with pilgrim traffic and watched by the enemy. I was certain, though, as certain as I was about anything in those confused times. Some of it was established protocol in the event of a catastrophe. Some of it was a vaguer sense of the way things were going. But most came from Locke's blood-scrawled message. Something he had meant me to find. I remain sure of it. Having seen that, I could hardly have done otherwise. If he had truly called us after so many millennia of painful silence, then I was surely bound to answer.
Chapter 7. Tearon. I had been so fixated on the problem of Cadia. We all had. That was perhaps why we all missed Fenris. I had barely even thought about the planet of the wolves. To me it was a semi-mythical place. I had heard plenty about its fearsome chapter, of course, but even then I'd never met one of its members. Space marines of any description were not common on Terra. I find it almost amusing to remember now, but the ancient prohibition on their presence here was one of the things that lingered after the old rationale for it had long since faded. It was said that the throne world still carried the scars of the great heresy, and so had kept its distance from the chapters out of a lingering sense of remembered terror. There was a little truth in that, and much nonsense. The visible scars of that old war were all still there, all the way from the highest domes of the palace down to the slum pits of the equatorial zone. But very few of the ordinary people, even many of the priests, had any clear idea what they represented. In the face of all that forgetfulness, the angels of death had long since ceased to be any kind of terror for the great mass of the population here. Indeed, if they read their ecclesiarchy catechisms, they probably near worshipped them as mythical saviors. What lingered was the wariness of the ruling classes. They knew their history, such as it still existed for us. They knew that even after the great reforms of the First Lord Commander, the combined strength of the Adeptus Astartes was still phenomenal, and that if those hundreds of miniature armies ever made common cause, then they would be by far the most powerful single block within the Imperium. And so the High Lords worked hard to maintain a distance between the throne world and the Chapter Masters. The Inquisition was not above sanctioning any that got too close for comfort, though in any case the antipathy was generally mutual. The chapters themselves preferred to be out in the void, able to fight the enemy where it persisted. And so, I had never laid eyes on a space wolf. I had never laid eyes on a dark angel or a white scar. The only ones I had ever witnessed, from a distance, were the golden warriors of Dawn's imperial fists, who still maintained a monastery on the world they had once garrisoned alone, and who were now the most frequent visitors to the glittering halls of the inner palace. Just like everything else, that would change. On that day, though, the tidings of strife were still coming in from a long way away. Fenris, I asked for a moment, assuming Jack had made a rare mistake. Undoubtedly, she replied, calm as ever. Something happened. There's talk of the Inquisition. Other chapters, too. I hear things I can scarcely believe, if I'm honest. But the sources are impeccable. Knowing what we know now, it seems inconceivable that we found out so late. And yet that was always the greatest burden we carried. The paucity of communication across our scattered and stormy domains. There were familiar stories, some apocryphal, many true, of entire wars beginning and ending before we on Terra ever became aware of them. Standard communication conduits were incredibly slow, relying on physical transport between worlds sundered by thousands of light years. Psychic communication was little better, unreliable, prone to madness and disruption, gnomic in its utterances. So do not blame us overmuch for the disaster of Fenris. It was not as if the wolves themselves had ever been eager to involve us in their many battles. We gain a grip in one place, another slips into danger, I muttered, already wondering what this would mean for our great undertaking. The Imperium, for all its faults, could act decisively and well when confronted with a single grand issue. When the war zones multiplied, That was when paralysis set in. Who else knows? By who, I meant the High Lords. Only they had access to better intelligence than we did. Not all of them, said Jack. Not yet. Haematalians, certainly. Arcs, probably. Keraplyades, we can assume, was the first to get tidings. But I've had nothing from our agent there. I don't think the Navy is informed yet. But if they start needing mass fleet movements, then Pereth will be next in line. It's not an isolated event, though, is it? I said thoughtfully. Jack waited for me to go on. She knew I wasn't asking her. You know, I never really listened to all those prophets of doom in the pulpits, I went on. I told myself they've been predicting the days of darkness for 1,000 years, and it never quite gets that bad. But first we have Armageddon, bleeding us white, and then this damned endless war at the eye. And now this. They keep piling up. I could learn to get religious. Jack laughed. You'd have plenty to atone for, she said. I didn't feel like laughing back. I tried not to think about the number of files I'd passed over bearing the galactic orientation for Fenris. There was always so much else to keep us busy. I began to think harder. Shocking as it is, it can help us, I said. If true, it'll be another argument to use in camera. Why are we keeping forces held back here when the threats increase? Throne, we have 10,000 of them here. That's 10 chapters. It's insane. We only had days then before the great conclave of the Camera Inferior. Anything back from the Captain General? Jack asked. That was the one remaining problem. I can't get close. I don't think you will now. I hated to admit defeat. It was the one fault I admitted readily. Back in the old days of scholar bullying, when I was beaten bloody by men who would go on to command regiments, I would lie in the dark, aching, and plot how best to come back from the humiliation. I would have tears still wet on my juvenile cheeks, but I would already be considering how to weaken the standing of my enemies, to spread the rumors that would isolate them, to call in the favors that would eventually see them humbled and in debt to me. Knowing when you're beaten, that's the route to certain defeat. I had heard so many high-ranking officials whisper to me over the past few years, "It's over, we've had it, we just can't raise the troops we need," and I had never believed a single one of them. The only true question was the one I had asked Haster. What can be done? But at that point, I could see no way forward. I had failed Fadix's test, and could not guarantee bringing the Captain General to the High Lord's table. In his absence, nothing would change, and we would remain passive as our defeats multiplied. You might be right, I muttered, hating the sound of the words, but unable to see past them. I woke up to the sound of the highest alarm level going off inside my ear. For a moment I had no idea where I was or what was happening. All I could hear was the tinny shriek of my cochlear alert, blazing. I shut it down and sat up, the silk sheets of my bed sliding from sweaty limbs. Lights, I said, and 3 pearly suspensers glowed into life. My room was in disarray, and for a moment I thought it had been ransacked. Then I remembered the events of the evening, the entertaining company, and the copious wine we had all sunk, and discounted that. I got up blearily, pulled on a robe, and twisted the sash around my fleshy waist. "Report," I ordered, speaking into the comm bead implanted in my wrist. "Violent incursion in Sector Lamba Sept of the Inner Palace," came the voice of the duty officer, a man named Revo Gemmel. "Countermeasures enacted, but severity required notification." "I'll be there," I said, slipping on shoes and reaching for a heavy cloak. "Send me the coordinates." Then I was running. I was not a good runner, you will not be surprised to hear. I waddled like an overfed fowl, my loose shoes slapping on the polished floors. As I went, as part of standard procedure, I was joined by members of my household guard, who jogged along behind me in deference to my uncertain pace. The destination was close, I reached an internal groundcar transport, and we bundled inside it, then hurtled down the transit tubes towards the inner ring of the palace interior. Through brief flashes from the armor glass portals, I saw the high spires streak by through the night, their flanks lit with sodium glare points. My earpiece was by then full of shouted orders, incoming reports, exclamations of surprise and horror. They had all known about the widespread disorder beyond the walls, but to have something take place inside, that was something else. I let them jabber. I was already ahead of them, notified first and in the best position to act. The ground car slammed into its terminus, now deep inside the Senatorum Imperialis complex itself, and we disembarked. The six guards fanned out around me protectively, and we plunged further in, racing through half-lit anterooms and audience halls. I knew them all, perhaps more than any mortal man living. I knew how to get from one side of the labyrinth to the other. And so we made swift progress. By then, I could already hear the snap of lasgun impacts, followed by the crash and splatter of priceless things breaking. We broke into a semi-ruined chamber, thick with old dust and the faded remnants of some Telek-era frescoes. The suspensers had been blown, and so we saw what happened only through whirling pools of head-mounted lumens. They were servitors, huge, vat-bulked servitors with heavy chain-glaives. They had been stamped with the livery of the palace, wore their ragged uniforms over obscenely muscled bodies, and were rampaging, storming down the center of the long room like enraged groxes. I estimated 20 of them were loose, charging at a nervous line of Palatine sentinels arrayed at the far end. My guards crouched to fire, leveling RAS rifles. "Hold," I said, walking out beyond their protection. The barrage of comm traffic in my Audex feed was giving me information they couldn't have heard, and I felt a tremor of excitement, tinged with terrible fear. I knew, you see, what was coming next. He broke through at the far end of the chamber, where the Palatines were, and instantly rendered them superfluous. Great panelled doors, smashed back on their hinges, rammed hard against the walls and splintering. Light flooded through the opening, dazzling and iridescent. He looked magnificent. If I'd not been so blindsided, I might have fallen down and worshipped that apparition. He moved like something out of legend, far faster than I was able to follow, impossibly fast for his huge bulk. A whirlwind of gold and black. The air screamed around him, blazing from where his great blade scythed and burned. He cut through the servitors as if they were nothing at all, just random tatters of useless machinery thrown up as an affront to his immortal dignity. I could barely even follow how he did it. The movement was so ludicrously quick, so horrifically powerful. And even then, I had the sense that he was barely tested. He flung his spear out wide and sent three of them, sailing into the far wall to crunch and sliver in a tangled mess. He punched out, breaking the neck of a fourth, then blasting a fifth with a stave-mounted bolter. The noise was incredible, a wall of snarling plasma burn that seemed to wreathe him in a cloak of distortion. And yet he said nothing at all. Only mindless servitors would not have fled shrieking then. But these flesh automata just kept on coming, zeroing their targeting sensors and blundering to get a shot. He barreled in among them, now twisting, now lunging, slicing his blade clean through the knots of grey flesh and burning metal. Another servitor was hurled into the air, limbs cartwheeling, before it crashed into the floor in a cloud of splintered tiles. Two more were decapitated with a two-handed heave, then more were blasted apart by the bolter. He worked almost casually. And yet nothing was casual at all. It was choreographed with such remorseless precision that it was more art than combat. And it only lasted seconds. That was all he needed. The echoes of his destruction took longer to die down, drifting over a smouldering scene of absolute annihilation. I had barely even fully registered his entrance before I was trying to make sense of what had just happened. marvelling at the volume of wreckage generated in such a tiny slice of time. Afterwards, he stood at the centre of it, his spear held loose, his black cloak sinking back around his shoulders. His helm lenses glowed like rubies in the dark, giving a faint red tinge to the baroque majesty of his closed-faced helm. His armour was even finer and more intensely adorned than Valerian's had been, a veritable hulk of heavy gold, emblazoned with thunderbolts and lightning strikes, the oldest of our ancient symbols, surrounded by astrological embellishments that seemed to writhe and grin in the flickering gloom. The guards beside me had not even had the chance to open fire. They were as stunned as I was, but then they had never been a significant factor here. The only two souls who mattered in that room were him and me. He knew what had happened even before his blade's energy field had kindled. That had always been the risk, and there were more risks to come. But desperate times required desperate remedies. He walked towards me. Every move he made was still bleeding with barely contained menace. I wanted to throw up then. I could feel saliva pooling at the back of my throat and swallowed thickly. "Get out," he said. He wasn't talking to me. The Palatine sentinels obeyed instantly, clattering out of the chamber in disciplined files. To their credit, my own guard hesitated for a moment or two, but their resolve was only human, and so they too withdrew. I was left looking up into the helm visor of Trajan Valoris, Captain General of the Adeptus Custodes, perhaps the deadliest individual warrior in the entire Imperium, and one whom I had just made very angry indeed. I started to blurt something out. "Silence," he commanded, and I stammered to a halt. "How did you know?" Somehow, my external comm feed had been closed by then. I assume he'd done that, and I felt terribly vulnerable. His voice, booming out of a voximeter, made my bones shiver. I wanted so badly to kneel, though that gesture would have achieved nothing. "Forgive me, Lord, I..." "How did you know?" I swallowed again. I felt light-headed. This was a gamble too far, and I cursed myself for daring it. Perhaps it would have been better to acknowledge defeat. "I arranged the transit of the Fabricator General's entourage to this zone," I said, trying to keep a lid on my fear. "He was the last one to arrive. I knew you would have been overseeing the security for his installation in person. I also knew the access codes. I also knew the access codes, and had the means to circumvent the security protocols. I needed to get you here. You and me." By then, he was standing over me. I could smell the blood and oil from the servitors slowly cooking on his still hot blade. I could feel the actinic tang of the energy field. I could trace the lines of that impossibly crafted armor and see just how achingly beautiful it was up close. I wondered if it might be my last sight. "Not a bad one," I thought grimly. "I have killed men for less than this," he said. I know," I said. "Your rank will not protect you." "I know." "Then why do it?" That was the question I'd been waiting for. If he truly made his mind up to execute me then and there, he would have not asked it. It was my only way in, though whether I would be able to take it was still very much moot. "Because my life really means very little," I said, trying my best to hold things together. "Almost nothing, I suppose, but I do know things. I can see how things are going, and I have a duty, when the call comes, to do what I can to aid the workings of the Council." I still felt nauseous, and had to fight the urge to vomit. "I've been trying to speak to you for weeks. All my other avenues are exhausted. This was the only thing I had left, and it had to be dared." He never made a move. After seeing just how astonishingly powerful he could be when in motion, watching him remain perfectly static was intimidating in itself. "I asked your shield captain for 5 minutes," I went on, doing what I could to look less than ridiculous. The request remains in place. He waited a long time. I was clammy with sweat by then, and feeling dizzy, and expected at any moment for the spear to come plunging into my neck. I wouldn't even have felt it, I imagine. I'd have never seen it coming. I felt my knees begin to give out. The last twitches and pops of the dying servitors were the only sounds in that place then, save for the faint grind of the power armor before me. I began to make my preparations. I had never been devout, but there were certain prayers one should recite at the hour of passing, and I still remembered some of the words. "Come with me, then," he said. He turned on his heel and stalked back through the bodies, mouthing a whispered thanks to whichever saint was watching over me that day. I pulled my robes about me and hurried to follow. Let me tell you what I knew of Trajan Valoris. The second of those use names was, I think, an honorific earned in battle, a prestige title that had long since passed out of use by the rest of the Imperium. Of course, he would have had a thousand other names, too, all inscribed within that carcass of Oromite, but it was standard protocol to refer to him as Valoris, on the rare occasions when any of his appellations were used directly. While the two tribunes of the Adeptus Custodes were generally occupied with the many ritual purposes of the Order, the Captain General had no set remit, but governed the forces under his command with complete freedom. To the extent that if the 10,000 had dealings with any part of the Adeptus Terra, they were carried out through him. The High Lords might seek to gain an audience, as might other great warriors, or the mightiest of our Inquisitor Lords, but only those of equivalent seniority. And that was it. There were no records in the Imperial databanks on his martial conquests, or his ascent into the Order. I didn't know what his name had been before he was taken into the Sanctum Imperialis, or where he had been born, or when. It might have been 100 years ago, or it might have been 5,000. For as long as I had been alive, though, his name had been spoken of with nothing short of reverence. Even the High Lords might be mocked, when in wine or in anger, but to do so with a Captain General was simply beyond imagination. In the Age of Wonder, it was said that the Emperor had employed a regent, a powerful figure who set in train the vast bureaucracy that would one day become the Administratum. And to speak ill of the Emperor's regent was a breath away from speaking ill of the Emperor. So it was with Valoris. While not officially numbered among the High Lords himself, there was little doubt that he was the closest thing we still possessed to the Emperor's own representative. And so, even when the fear of imminent death had subsided a little, I remained daunted by this figure. I was not generally swayed by reputations, for I had seen how often they were false masks hiding small minds, but this one was quite literally a breed apart. He led me deeper into the palace, and soon we were down in the crypts below one of the great battle chapels commemorating the first Ulanor triumph. By the time he stopped walking, it felt as if we had descended into the heart of the planet. The stone around us was cold and cracked with age, and the only light came from the glow of his helm lenses and the residual aura of his magnificent armor. "You wanted 5 minutes," he said. I might have asked if this place was secure from listening devices, but immediately thought better of it. He had brought me here. Of course it was. "I hear reports from every corner of the Imperium," I started, trying to control the shake in my voice and remember who I was and whom I worked for. "In truth, I hear more than anyone else, even the High Lords, for they all have their fiefs to watch, and I have allegiance to both none and all. And though I risk telling you what you already know, I see a tipping point being reached now. I see the losses we're taking becoming irrecoverable, and I can't stand back and do nothing." He was silent as I spoke, but slowly reached up to his helm and took it off. I don't know what I was expecting to see. Perhaps something like Valerian had been, with his smooth skin and pleasant complexion. Valoris was nothing of the kind. His visage was hard-edged, broken by scar tissue, the skin veined and vivid. His lips were thin, his nose flared, his neck sinewy. In that low light, no doubt amplified by my own fear, he looked almost ghoulish. "It is not your task to tell me this," he said. Once free of his helm, his voice was low, considered. "In the normal run of things, yes, that's right," I said, working to keep my composure. "But the composition of the council is within my purview, and the Lord Brack is gone, throne preserve his soul, and there's no consensus on who should replace him. And then there's dissolution, which has been discussed and discussed, but never been ruled on." Valoris placed his empty helm on the altar beside him. He leaned his great spear against one of the columns, and the cutting blade clinked against the stone. Then he regarded me with those terrible bloodshot eyes. "And you wish me to settle the issue?" he said. "None of this is new to me. But since then, my lord, we have had word of catastrophe on Fenris, and two fleets have been lost en route to the edges of Segmentum Solar to reinforce the supply lines of Warmaster Catasp. These are hardly trivial setbacks. And then there is Cadia, the gate into the eye. You seem to think, Chancellor, that we are unaware of this." "No, not at all. But you may not have the perspective I do." His gaze, as unbending as the granite around us, never wavered. I wondered what it might look like if he tried to smile. "I know what you wish for," Valoris said. "And you know we had this chance before, when Speaker Lestia died. We did not take it then. The reason was simple. The High Lords rule the Imperium, and we are not of the Imperium." I remembered that Valerian had said the same thing. "There was a time when his vision was manifest. All you see around you now, all that has been built over 10,000 years, none of that is his. While you have forgotten, we remember. But there were captains general on the council before, when the need was greatest." I could not help myself. I let slip a wry smile. "And now the need is great, lord. The need is very great indeed." "For the Imperium," Valoris agreed. "If my first duty were to your mortal realm, the case would be strong. But my first duty is to the Emperor. We are his guardians, not an army under the council." "Yes, that is what you have become. But it was not always the way." And then, for the first time, I detected the smallest indication of surprise. Knowledge of the Great Crusade was vanishingly rare, even in the highest levels of the hierarchy, but I had access to many obscure libraries, and had made it the subject of much study. Once I knew the custodians had waged war in the farthest reaches of the galaxy, and not invariably with the Emperor at their head.